Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 7th of May. 7th of May. We're happy to have E.J. Dionne with us this hour of the program. His latest book is Sold Out, S-O-U-L-E-D, Out, Reclaiming Faith in Politics After the Religious Right. He is a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post, a regular political analyst on National Public Radio. You hear him frequently. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown University. His other books include Why Americans Hate Politics. And I understand his wife came up with the title of that book and that it was a family effort to come up with the title of this book, this new one, which is good. Our phone number, I've read a lot of the book and we're going to get to it, but we can't start this hour without, because he talks about politics so frequently, about what happened yesterday in North Carolina and Indiana. He writes that he hopes that this book might contribute to broadening the conversation about religion and politics. It is aimed at both the believer and the non-believer, and unapologetically an attempt to influence the political dialogue in the post-Bush era. It is intended to make the case that liberals dare not relegate people of faith to some outer darkness or supposed ignorance, even if liberals have every right to oppose ideologues on the right who invoke faith for narrow electoral purposes. Many liberals discovered God in the exit polls after the 2004 election. The book is a case for taking religion seriously or for not using it in a slapdash way to win an election or two. And he's covered religion, too. He's covered the Catholic Church extensively and has spent a long time thinking about this issue. It's very obvious from reading it. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655 or 414-227-2050. Send an email if you would like. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. E.J. Dionne, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for that incredibly kind introduction, and thanks for calling everybody's attention to the fact that my family played a vital role in naming my book.
No, I think that's great.
Yeah, so this book was titled on a family car trip out to the eastern shore of Maryland, and so thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, your son came up with the word, you came up with the word, and there was the title, and
yes,
it worked.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. That's it. So yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah, you're entirely welcome. I must ask you about North Carolina and Indiana before we talk about the book, which we will.
I thought that might happen.
Yeah,
a very interesting night.
Wasn't it?
I think there are a couple of things. I think now it is, if it was very hard for Mrs. Clinton to take the nomination before last night, it is now almost impossible. I think she really had to win Indiana by a substantial margin and either win North Carolina outright or win it so narrowly that Obama would start looking like a weak candidate and lots of people would begin to have doubts about him. None of that happened. On the contrary, Obama won a victory that in North Carolina that far exceeded anything that his own people anticipated, as far as I could tell, let alone Mrs. Clinton's folks. And her victory in Indiana turned out to be very, very narrow, and we went early into the morning mm-hmm. until we figured out Indiana. I think what that's going to do is begin to free up superdelegates who had been inclined to go to Obama to end the race and free them up to go to him. I think there were a number of superdelegates who, after all, are politicians, elected officials, plus members of the Democratic National Committee. Those are the two largest groups who didn't want to look like they were just shutting down the Clinton campaign before there was some decisive result. And I think for a significant number of them, this will be enough to say, okay, this is done. I think one other fact, if I could mention it,
sure.
Because it actually involves the state of Wisconsin. Mrs. Clinton, when you look back on this, her campaign really dug a hole for her in the month of February.
Hmm.
This campaign, assuming nothing happens to derail Obama now, this campaign was settled in February. First, because Mrs. Clinton had this inevitability strategy,
right.
And her campaign really did not organize the caucus states to anything like the degree that Obama did. Going into yesterday, the Obama had a lead of somewhere between 135 and 140 delegates. 132 of those came from caucus states. Now then, because she had the inevitability strategy, she really was not well organized in the 2 weeks after the Super Tuesday primaries on February 5th. That's my state of Maryland, where I live, mm-hmm. and Virginia, and then Wisconsin. In those 2 weeks alone, Obama netted 73 more of his lead. So really, more that my math says that's 205 delegates that he netted from either caucuses or those 2 weeks. And Mrs. Clinton's campaign never recovered from that mistake, which turned almost every primary night into a do-or-die situation. And that's a very, very difficult circumstance.
That's interesting.
I'm sorry, there's a little buzzing behind me that I cannot figure out. Somebody's working on a building somewhere.
Oh, that's okay. We don't hear it. I hope it.
Oh, good.
Can hear
oh,
us.
Excellent.
And yet she was really sparkling the last few weeks, as you know. After Pennsylvania, she was just pounding the pavement, and she was happy as could be. And he looked as down as I've ever seen him. He was just flat. Considering the fact that there is momentum and momentum builds on momentum, how did he pull off this very large victory in North Carolina and very close in Indiana when he'd had probably the worst 3 weeks of his whole campaign?
Well, first, I entirely agree with you. In my column Tuesday morning, I argued that one irony of this race is that Hillary Clinton found a compelling voice and a plausible strategy only after she had squandered her chances of winning the nomination without this big struggle over superdelegates in convention rules. And I think defeat galvanized her. And I think she's somebody who fights well in adversity. And she became, you know, I mentioned this on NPR last night, the song that kept going through my head is a song from a few years back, "I Get Knocked Down, But I Get Up Again,
right,
You're Never
yeah.
Going to Keep Me Down." And that was kind of a campaign. I don't know if they ever used it, but they could have.
Right.
And Obama clearly was thrown by his own comments on bitter voters clinging to the Bible and the Bibles and guns, and then, of course, this Jeremiah Wright fiasco. My own view is that, paradoxically, Mrs. Clinton did Barack Obama a favor by endorsing this holiday for the gas tax, because Obama came back to life when he started fighting against that. You know, in the first place, I think if you're going to pander, you might as well pander for something more than about $28 over the summer. So it wasn't a big enough proposal that would draw a lot of votes. But Obama was able to rediscover his old voice as someone who was against Washington gimmicks and against Washington's way of doing business. And this gas tax controversy, small as it is in a certain respect, really pushed right back in the news. And I think in the last sort of several days of the campaign, the old inspiring Obama seemed to come back with energy. And I think you really saw that Obama reappear last night in his victory speech. A friend and I were talking this morning, and it was sort of an Obama's back moment for him.
Yes.
So I think in the end, her embrace of this gas tax holiday might have been a very serious tactical error that allowed him to get off the mat and start fighting again.
Yeah, he was very good last night. That speech was superb, and it was tuned a little more. Don't you think that he was more specific, because he's been criticized for, we like the way he talks, but what's he talking about, that he really had specific ideas, whereas she appeared pretty down, and Bill was just as glum as could be.
Right. Well, I think he was very disappointed by North Carolina, because he worked very, very hard. And again, I think just as there was a new Mrs. Hillary Clinton, there was a new Bill Clinton. He was out there being positive, being his old self, going to all these little towns. And it was the Clinton that, many Democrats used to like a lot, but some of whom got estranged from in the course of this primary. And he, too, was back. And so I think he expected all that work, both in North Carolina and also in Indiana, to pay off far more than it did. I think for Obama, what was critical is it was a fresh speech, and it was, it was new material directly aimed at the troubles he had been to. The whole point about voters not being distracted, not being divided by fear, and that it was directly addressed to the problems he's faced in the last few weeks, and it really was more a general election speech. It was a kind of not just a victory speech for North Carolina. It was a victory speech for the entire thing. And you could see that in how accommodating he tried to be. You know, he had the little jab at Mrs. Clinton that North Carolina was supposed to be a game changer. That was a quote from her. You know, the game people want changed is a game in Washington. But for the rest of it, it was all accommodating to her. And he conceded her victory in Indiana before any network other than CBS had called it for her. So, I think it was a forward-looking speech. And again, I think he did finally seem to be someone who had his heart in it again.
Yeah,
it looked
right.
Like the heart had been knocked out of him by all these controversies.
Yeah, I wholly agree. Is it his? Is it his now?
I don't see how he can lose it short of some, catastrophic new piece of information, which I don't think is there. I just don't see a path for her anymore. If she had knocked him out, if she had won both those primaries, I think the whole race would have changed mm-hmm. because then it would have been a very long time since he had won a major contest. And I think a lot of Democrats, even Democrats sympathetic to Obama, would say, gee, is there more weakness here than we thought there was. And by winning, I think he put a lot of those fears to rest. It doesn't mean he didn't suffer some real damage in this period. I think when you listen to Republicans talk this morning, they're less afraid of Obama today than they were 2 or 3 months ago when it looked like he'd sweep the board and even start getting a lot of conservative votes. I think Republicans are less worried than they were. On the other hand, I think Obama showed that he was probably tougher in the end than either Senator Clinton or the Republicans thought he was.
Yeah. All right. I love this. We're doing religion and politics, all these things you're not supposed to talk about.
Well, I suspect a few callers might want to talk about the primary, so we can talk a little bit of but say a few prayers and then go back to raw politics.
Okay. Let's talk about these fresh religious voices that you write about who are rising to challenge the stereotypical views of religious faith. What are the stereotypical views, and who are these new, fresh voices?
Well, if I can say, the reason I ended up liking the title Sold Out so much is because it really spoke to the two core arguments in my book. On the one hand, the sense of exhaustion people have with religion and Christianity in particular being used in a narrow partisan and ideological way, as if religion is only about a few issues, abortion, gay marriage, stem cell research, and not about what our great traditions have always been about, instructing us on how we organize our society, on larger questions of justice and war and peace. And historically, our traditions were very engaged in the large fights in our society, the anti-slavery movement, the progressive movement, the civil rights movement. And so this narrowing of religion is one thing people are exhausted by. The other sense is that it's a great sellout of religion to say that it's only about these narrow issues because of this rich history, particularly in our country, where religion has been a real prod to the social change that, in retrospect, I think most of us, including many of our conservative friends, now welcome. And there are two people I talk about a lot of individuals in the book. Two people I think are particularly interesting. One is Rick Warren. Now, Rick Warren is, I always say that any author who talks about Rick Warren is committing the sin of covetousness in his or her heart, because Rick is an evangelical preacher, quite conservative on social issues. He published a book called The Purpose-Driven Life, which has sold somewhere around 25 or 30 million copies.
Woo.
And unless every one of your listeners buys about 10,000 copies of my book, I doubt, I know I will never sell 25 or 30 million copies. But Rick, while being very conservative on issues such as gay marriage or abortion, is also reads his Bible whole. And he says, well, Jesus said a lot about the poor and a lot about the distressed and the sick and our obligations to them. He got his church, the Saddleback Valley Church in Orange County, California, very involved in the battle against AIDS in Africa and helping victims of AIDS. Mm. And he invited two major politicians to his church about a year and a half ago who had been very involved in this issue. One, a good conservative Republican, Sam Brownback from Kansas, and the other, a young senator named Barack Obama. Well, Rick Warren took a lot of grief from conservatives for inviting the pro-abortion liberal Obama to his church, and he didn't back down. And what he said when he was asked by somebody from ABC News about this, he said, look, people ask if I am right-wing or left-wing. Actually, I'm for the whole bird. And I think what you're seeing is a lot of whole bird Christianity growing out there. The other person, just briefly, is Rich Cizik. He directs the National Association of Evangelicals, which I can assure you is not the equivalent of MoveOn.org in its politics. Rick decided that we, you know, reading his scripture, we have an obligation to the stewardship of the earth. And he put the NAE and in the large sections of the evangelical movement behind the fight against global warming. Again, he got grief for that from the right, stood up to the right. His board backed him 37-1, I think the vote was. And it's just a reflection of how the agenda, even of theologically conservative Christians, is broadening from this narrow list of hot-button issues.
Mm-hmm. Look at Huckabee.
Well, Huckabee, I think, is a fascinating figure. I argue that he has kind of one foot in the old religious right and one foot in this new thing that's happening. On the one hand, he is, again, quite conservative on issues like abortion and gay marriage. But even when he talks about abortion, he often, and I was with him a fair amount on the campaign trail, he often broadened it to talk about the right to life involving human rights for all. He once said, you know, the right to life doesn't just mean the baby in the womb. It means the baby under the bridge, poor kids in the country. He talked about health care. He talked about education. He talked about economic inequality. He was as much an evangelical populist as he was an evangelical conservative.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that once the media paid much attention to a real broad range of religious figures, Paul Tillich, Karl Barth, Reinhold Niebuhr, but then all of a sudden we got this change here and the attention was lavished on Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, James Dobson, et cetera. How did that happen, E.J.?
First of all, I think it's I'm glad you raised that because I think it's important to note that it, as the so-called liberal media was very complicit in this. And I sometimes wondered if there was a kind of pact between certain kinds of liberals and certain kinds of people on the religious right, because it was good to be able to blame defeat on the religious right or to have this big enemy out there. And you're absolutely right. One of the heroes of my book is Reinhold Niebuhr, the great liberal Protestant theologian, who wrote from basically the 1930s into the 1960s, and who had a very sober view of human nature, but also a hopeful view of human possibility. You know, he got on the cover of Time magazine. The figures who were involved in the broad public conversation, including the conversation about politics, were complicated, serious people. After the rise of the religious right, and given the impact they seemed to have, particularly in the 1980 campaign with the election of Ronald Reagan, they sort of grabbed a monopoly on public attention. That led an awful lot of people to assume that religion always lives on the right, which, as I argue, is totally inconsistent with our history. Of course, there are conservatives. Indeed, in the book, I argue that, you know, that religion can be legitimately seen as both conservative and progressive. You safeguard a tradition by honoring it, but you often have to preserve a tradition by adapting it in light of new circumstances. But it was all conservatives all the time, and many of these other voices just disappeared, or they're and I think that's changing now too. My friend Jim Wallace, whom I'm sure has been on your air before, is a good example of a powerful progressive Christian voice, and there are many others. And then, as I say, there are also folks who had been traditionally seen as conservative who are now insisting on a broader agenda for religion and, as I say, particularly Christianity in public life.
E.J. Dionne is our guest, and we're going to welcome phone calls for him in just a moment. His book is sold out, Reclaiming Faith and Politics After the Religious Right. You, of course, are quite familiar with him from his terrific analysis on National Public Radio. He's a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, professor at Georgetown University, and his other books include Why Americans Hate Politics. One line is open, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start with Mike from Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Hi, this is Mike. I just want to say the lack of concern for politics is it's kind of sickening. I don't know. I've been all over the place, like MATC, that's the college around here, and I just talk to people, and it just seems like there's just like no hope left. I don't know. It's kind of weird. That's pretty much all I wanted to say.
You think there's no hope? Yeah, I think all the interest. Like, I think the interest in this campaign shows that there is a lot of hope.
Well, right. I agree with that. I think that, you know, first of all, I think that an awful lot of the time, an awful lot of people are very engaged in their own lives, in the struggles of their own lives, and they may not be as engaged in politics as those of us who are political junkies might be. I must say that my son's high school baseball team played at Nats Stadium last night. It was the first time my 15-year-old son got to play baseball in a major league park. And for 2 hours, even I completely forgot about politics.
Oh, that must have been a thrill.
Very, very exciting.
Yes.
And, you know, but I think this year you are seeing, and there's a lot of evidence of this from the surveys, that people are more engaged in politics now. And I think that, you know, this goes through cycles. I think when people see that the country is in trouble, and I think a lot of people across the spectrum agree the country's in considerable trouble right now, they get engaged. When they see that the choices before them can have a real impact on the future, they get engaged. And you saw that in the 2004 election with a very substantial increase in voter turnout. So I share the caller's view that political indifference is a bad idea, but I don't see nearly as much of that now as, you know, we have seen at other moments in the past.
Tell me, I'm always interested in those people in our lives who have made us who we are today, and I love the parts of your book where you talk about Sister Genevieve and the Benedictine monks and the people who have made you who you are, how you write, how you think. Could you talk about them some, starting with Sister Genevieve?
Yes, and I don't want to blame any of those folks for my flaws. Those are all my own work. But Sister Genevieve was a sixth-grade teacher of mine at St. Matthew's School in Fall River, Massachusetts. And she was a lovely woman with this deep Southern drawl, teaching all of us nasal New England kids. And I wondered why we had a nun, who most of the nuns were from the area, why did we have a nun who had this deep Southern drawl? And I learned that Sister Genevieve and I had been a nun down in Louisiana in the years when segregation was really, people were really clinging to it in the 1950s. And she got kicked out of a parish in Louisiana because she had organized a racially integrated First Communion service. And Sister Genevieve didn't do this because she was some stereotypical radical nun. She was simply a Christian who thought, what an absurd thing to segregate the first reception of the Eucharist for these little kids. And I say in the book that this had an enormous impact on my view of civil rights from that day forward. I talk about my parents. My dad was a dentist. He was quite conservative in his politics. He was also a very generous man and a very warm-spirited Christian. And he, during the Great Depression, set up a free dental clinic, which he helped organize local dentists to help poor kids who couldn't afford to see a dentist. And that kept going until the day he died in 1968, and I think it kept going for many years after. My mom was a teacher and a librarian, and what I say in the book is that I think for a lot of us, if we're honest with ourselves, our attitudes toward religion are often shaped by these very early experiences, and that religion can be presented as or experienced as very confining and narrowing. In my case, and I think in the case of an awful lot of people, religion was not like that. It was a place of community. It was a place that religion was a source of values. And when you look at people who actually live up to the demands of their creed, you don't automatically say, as some skeptics of religion say, oh, those folks are a bunch of hypocrites. Well, there are a lot of religious people out there, including, by the way, people whose politics I disagree with, who are not hypocritical at all, who are very generous in their behavior toward others. Conservatives, actually, there's some evidence, may be religious conservatives may be more generous than those of us who are liberal in their own private charity. This has a real effect on people. And then my Benedictine monks, I'm glad you raised them. I went to a wonderful Benedictine school where almost all the monks became priests, monks, after they had done something else in life, so that the headmaster of the school had worked on the atomic bomb project, was a great physicist, and other of my teachers had been an actor in New York City. These were some of the smartest people I ever met. So when anybody told me, oh, these religious people are not intelligent, they you don't understand, these were very smart, civilized people. So I have always sort of pushed back against the idea that religious people should be stereotyped in the way, unfortunately, some of my progressive friends and allies do sometimes.
Mm-hmm. What about the role, and you write about this at some length, which I find interesting, the role of atheists and secularists who you say have a legitimate grievance against a narrowly politicized form of religion?
Yeah, no, I have, I express in the book a complicated view of atheists. On the one hand, I argue that believers should actually welcome the challenge of atheists, because atheists take the question of belief at least as seriously as believers do, and that if believers can't defend their faith before the intelligent questions of atheists, they need to go back to the drawing boards. I wrote a column about this once defending atheists, because if I don't like prejudice against religious people, I also don't like prejudice against atheists. And I used, I quoted a headline that had run on a wonderful piece in the New Republic by Leon Wieseltier. The headline was, God Bless Atheists. And I got my favorite email from a reader, one of my very favorite emails, which began, Dear Mr. Dion, I am an atheist, and if I may say so, God bless you, which I thought was very sweet. But the new atheist writers, I am critical of, because I think they are as dogmatic as the dogmatists they condemn. Christopher Hitchens, who's a brilliant polemicist, has in the subtitle of his book the assertion that, you know, religion poisons everything. Well, I simply don't believe that's true. I don't think it's supportable in any way by the facts. Yes, religion can be misused. Yes, it has been abused. But religion has also called forth, as we were just talking about, extraordinary acts of generosity and compassion, extraordinary acts of resistance to injustice that you saw in our own civil rights movement, in the resistance to the communist dictatorship in Poland, the monks in Burma. And so I think that this sort of sweeping indictment of religion by these particular atheist writers is simply wrong.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Let's go to Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. In 1963, I was 19 years old, and that'll tell you something about how idealistic I probably was at that time, with the civil rights movement beginning and John F. Kennedy kind of inspiring the nation and saying, you know, there's a new frontier. I make reference to my personal history because I think what has happened in America since the Kennedy and King and other assassinations and so on and so forth is that Americans have grown increasingly tired of a politics of religion, rejection of others, of sort of public humiliation of others, that slowly but surely we're coming to terms with who we are as a people who try to hold ourselves together through a variety of means, and that if you look like at something like what is called the pro-lifers versus the pro-choicers, what you see on both sides is people who are suffering, and they are suffering not in the right way, because they are suffering because they think they must get only their way. And slowly but surely, both religionists and non-religionists may come around, may be inspired to say something like, you know, if you have a pregnancy that you want to end, you are a suffering person. And if you are a person who wants to end the use of abortion to address a real injustice that's being done to women as you perceive it, we have some things in common. I just want to go back to the idea of Martin Luther King. He wrote Why We Can't Wait in a time when people said, you gotta wait. You're pushing too hard on this kind of thing. And today, people make it sound like He was a hero back in 1963. He wasn't. He was hated. And only now are we coming to terms with the possibility of, I don't even like the term, black people in the White House. Only now are we coming to terms with the idea of we're all in this together. That's why I've backed Barack Obama, not because I know so much about him, but because I really do believe it's time to turn it over to young people who are tired mm-hmm. of this idea of we're better if we publicly humiliate each other or reject each mm-hmm. other. And I don't have your book yet, but I want to get it, and I hope at some point you'll make reference to Mel White's Religion Gone Bad, The Hidden Dangers of the Christian Right, not because he rejects the Christian right, but because he's tried to embrace them.
Thanks, Rich, for your call.
I want to thank the caller for that call. Incidentally, in that introductory essay, for me, the Martin Luther King book that was very important was a collection of his sermons called Strength to Love, which mm-hmm. I ended up writing a paper on in high school, and it really did shake my view of things. I'm a little bit younger than the caller. He sounds much younger than his actual age. But I really appreciate his call because and his raising the abortion issue, because I talk about that at some length in the book, and it seems to me that we really do need a new conversation about abortion in the country. That we've abortion has been broadly legal for 35 years since Roe v. Wade. We've been having the same fight about abortion over and over again. If you look at sort of the instincts on the pro-life and pro-choice side, the best instinct on the pro-life side is that we should protect the most vulnerable, and for them, the fetus is the most vulnerable being there is. On the pro-life side, the best instinct is we want to preserve the autonomy and the freedom of women to make their own reproductive instincts. It's not hard to understand why somebody is pro-life or why someone is pro-choice. I argue that we will never, in most of our country, I think the polls show that if Roe fell, 90% of Americans would live in states that would likely keep abortion legal. Moreover, it's not at all clear that making abortion illegal would in any way eliminate abortion in the United States. On the contrary, abortion would simply go underground and it would become more dangerous. On the other hand, I do believe there are too many abortions in the country. Our abortion rate is higher in many cases than the abortion rate in other countries where abortion is legal. What I suggest is a deal, which is let us agree on non-criminal measures to reduce the number of abortions in the United States. On the one side, that would mean doing more than we do to reduce the number of unintended pregnancies. And we've had great success, which we don't celebrate enough, in reducing the teen pregnancy rate very substantially over the last 15, 20 years. On the other hand, if their poor women have abortions at a much higher rate than wealthy women, should we not do more to help poor women who want to bring their children into the world? Is not a poor woman more likely to choose life, to bring new life into the world, if she knows that she has a decent job, economic security, a way of raising the child, and health coverage to cover her during her pregnancy and afterwards? So let's sort of push aside this old argument and agree that we're going to find ways of taking steps that all of us can agree are good things in and of themselves that might reduce the number of abortions in the country.
Thanks very much for the call. As always, an interesting one, Rich. We have to pause for a moment. E.J. Dionne is our guest. He is the author of Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith and Politics After the Religious Right. He's a commentator, of course, on National Public Radio, a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, professor at Georgetown University, and author of a number of other books. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. E.J. Dionne is our guest. His book, again, is Sold Out, S-O-U-L-E-D, Reclaiming Faith in Politics After the Religious Right. And we take more phone calls to Ed from West Allis. Hi.
Well, yes, today is May 7th, Kathleen, the Feast of St. Stanislaus Kostka on the Catholic calendar. And there's
Bless you for that.
Well,
thank you.
Yes, it is. I should say the traditional Catholic calendar. There's not a scintilla of evidence not one scintilla of evidence that this theory that the religious right is somehow going to give up its stranglehold on American political politics simply because, through the aegis of Karl Rove, they have been merged and melded with the new political right, the crystals of this world, the Father John McLaughlin's S.J., and the Monica Crowley's. I don't know if you've been watching the McLaughlin Report, but we have a new conservative in the chair. And I find it very interesting that when Mr. Dionne went through his litany of causes, the anti-slavery movement, the civil rights movement, the one movement he forgot was the labor movement. We have been decimated by these evil evangelicals in this country. Most of the evangelicals live in right-to-work states where unions are despised and hated. And the only antidote to the evangelical right-wing movement in this country is the labor movement. And we stand at 8.1% of the population right now. And we don't have a candidate in this race that we can support. And you're going to see, as we move toward November, the dislocated workers just getting more disenfranchised and disaffected during the course of this campaign.
All right, let's get a response. EJ.
First of all, it is true we hadn't mentioned labor yet. I do mention it in the book. In fact, I talk quite a lot about Monsignor John Ryan, some about Monsignor George Higgins, who are two leading labor priests who cared a lot. Father Ryan wrote a book back in 1906 called The Living Wage, and that the Catholic Church in particular, but other parts of our religious world, were very strongly behind the labor movement. And indeed, the Catholic bishops wrote an economic program called the Program for Social Reconstruction back in 1919, which in many ways prefigured the New Deal. It was a pretty pure New Deal document before we even knew there would be a New Deal. So I agree with the caller on the importance of the labor movement and the importance of religious voices within our labor movement. In terms of this campaign, you know, the certainly organized labor, most of the leading unions, have picked a side and see Barack Obama, some see Hillary Clinton as the best champion for labor. But I think I'm less pessimistic in terms of labor's political impact on this campaign. But he's right. The labor movement has been decimated in our country, particularly in the private sector. And I think it's very important to social justice that it be rebuilt.
Thanks, Ed, very much for your call. Gustavo is next from Appleton. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to ask your guests to please comment on the Reverend John Hagee's endorsement of John McCain and the deafening silence of the press about it, or at least the lack of traction the issue seems to have had in general. Frank Rich published an article yesterday in the New York Times about it, and I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
I actually wrote a column about this, I guess, ran it April 2nd in the Washington Post, where I raised this very question, which is, why is it that white right-wing preachers have it easier, or so it seems, than black left-wing preachers? And, of course, I was writing about the controversy surrounding Jeremiah Wright, and, of course, there are things that Jeremiah Wright said that I found offensive and mistaken. On the other hand, he is in a prophetic tradition within the black church. But there are things he said that are offensive. But there were a lot of things that Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson have said that are deeply offensive. The famous Falwell line that I believe that pagans and abortionists and feminists and lesbians and gays were essentially behind 9/11. I have the long quote in my a column, and I mentioned the Reverend Hagee, who has called the Catholic Church, and forgive me, I ask forgiveness from your audience for repeating what he said. He called the Catholic Church the great whore of Babylon and the Antichrist, and he endorsed John McCain. I entirely agree that there should be more attention to this. I think it's being mentioned. Frank Rich wrote about it in the New York Times on Sunday as well. And I think that will be an issue down the road. But yes, I thoroughly agree with the caller that if we're going to be critical of the things that certain left-wing preachers say, we should be equally critical to offensive or offensive things that right-wing preachers say. But I don't think that issue has gone away.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join our conversation with EJ. 800-486-8655 is the number. 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. And our email is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. You I found it interesting, EJ, that you included this few pages on this movie that we all watch over and over and over again. And I wonder what it says about values, politics, religion. It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, well, thank you for raising that. I argue in the book that It's a Wonderful Life may tell us everything that we need to know about how Americans look at the intersection of values and politics. And I think most of your listeners, or at least enough of them, are familiar with the movie, so I won't go through the entire plot. But I think just think about a couple of things, and I write it up actually as a focus group report, because I say it's much cheaper to watch this movie than to pay for a focus group on American values. And if you look at the Jimmy Stewart character, George Bailey, on the one hand, he is a capitalist, just like Mr. Potter, the evil banker in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But Jimmy Stewart is a capitalist who believes that the bounty of capitalism should be broadly shared. And he is well-loved in town because he has helped so many working people enjoy a stake in their town, own their own homes. And it's a kind of, it's a respect for labor, it's a respect for the average person, and that capitalism without any moral limits is not the kind of capitalism we want in the United States. We believe in market economics, but we believe in market economics within moral limits. The other lesson, I have it longer in the book, but the other lesson I'll highlight here is that if we care about decent moral values and family values, we also have to worry about economic justice. And that when Jimmy Stewart is presented with the alternative universe, what would have happened if he had not lived? And he goes back to his town, Bedford Falls, which is renamed Pottersville after the evil banker. And because all these folks never got a decent shot in life, they're angry, they're resentful. It's become a honky-tonk town of prostitutes and a lot of drinking. And so that if you really care about those family values we talk a lot about, you've got to care about the whole social and economic structure of your community, because that helps determine whether you can have the kind of moral community that people talk so much about in our politics, but probably don't do what certainly don't do enough to build.
Yeah. Scott from Sturgeon Bay, hello.
Good afternoon. Actually, good morning still. I just have two quick comments and a question. Other than Rick Warren, a great book, A Generous Orthodoxy by Brian McLaren, who basically proclaims our orthodoxy is not correct or generous when it comes to religion. The other quick comment was regarding how Reverend Wright was covered, which I think was over the top, but the Christian right, that term in itself, has now become a derogatory comment. It's a negative connotation, being part of the Christian right. So I think covering right the way it's been covered, I think white preachers and Christian conservatives have been covered for so long, and the coverage of him is kind of new. So I think it is balanced by most points. But my question was, do you think maybe the rise of the religious right, the Robertsons, the Falwells, the Nagys, if there's any correlation to the right, correlating that with what a lot of people perceive as the left trying to dismiss religion, to eliminate it from the public square?
Oh, amen to that question. First of all, I'm glad you mentioned Brian McLaren. We had I admire him enormously myself, and we had a very good exchange along with some other folks when the book came out on the Talking Points Memo website. And he was very kind to the book, which I'm grateful for, but he also, more importantly, had a lot of fascinating things to say. So thank you for mentioning Brian McLaren. I totally agree with this last point. Indeed, it's one of the central points in my book, that you know, one of the great things about being about liberalism is that it is always fought against prejudice, whether racial prejudice or anti-Semitism or prejudice against gays and lesbians. Liberals ought not be prejudiced against people of faith. And I think there are times when liberals have been dismissive toward people of faith. And I think when you think about the origins of the popular support for the religious right, not the organizers who were often in it for partisan reasons, but the rank and file, theirs was a demand for respect and attention, that they not be dismissed as ignorant with nothing to say about politics. And so, yes, I think that this is a two-sided issue. I think conservatives should stop dismissing all liberals as somehow immoral, ungodly, anti-religion, but liberals should not be dismissing religious people, as I say, even those with whom we have political disagreements. We have a right to fight the abuse of religion, but we should not dismiss rank-and-file religious people who are, just like all of us are, trying to live decent lives and trying to think their way through their own tradition.
Thank you for the call. Jordan from Marengo. Hi.
Hey, good morning. This should put a stick in the hornet's nest a little bit. I was in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, just before shock and awe. I was compelled to go to a Wellesian church, and the preacher was up there doing the sermon, and the thrust of it completely was, as Christians, we need to support George Bush in this coming invasion of Iraq, because biblically we know that this is the beginning of the end time and the call to the rapture, and all of us believers, lucky us, will get to go up, and the rest of the heathens will get to duke it out on the planet, you know, never mind suggesting that that's the death and destruction of millions of women and children overseas. And, you know, compared to the Reverend Wright's comments, I just found that so much more despicable, basically, so self-interested and so smug that I think that that kind of religion does need to be resisted, really, and that take of our own righteousness versus, you know, screw the rest of you, basically. And, you know, so I guess I guess I'd just like a reaction to that comment, because, you know, it's quite a few years ago, and I'm still just really mad about it. So
you can tell. Jordan, thanks for the call.
Yes, no, I am not that sort of Christian myself, and I do find the rapture theology at best somewhat strange, at least to me, and that when it's but it's one thing for people to believe in that theology, it's another to apply it politically in the way that preacher did, which I agree is totally wrong. In fact, one of the reasons Niebuhr is one of my heroes is that he argues that religious people, especially the United States as a powerful country in the world, should have a degree of humility about its power, and that we have to look, we who are religious, have to look at our own sinfulness and judge ourselves by some very tough standards, that it's easy to judge other people by our tough standards. It's much harder to judge ourselves by those tough standards. I think for myself, and I think for millions and millions of Americans, the kind of religious commitment that Niebuhr described, this this effort to be self-critical and to question one's own motives, is the way to go, and is the way a lot of people go.
One more phone call I think we have time for. Tom from Burlington. Hi.
I believe the abortion is a death sentence, and it should be handled just like a death sentence and put into a court of law or a duly appointed a tribunal by a jury. But my question to you was, do you think that abortion has become a commonplace, and how will it affect this election or not? In the terms of the last 40 years, we have not elected a pro-choice president, just Mr. Clinton.
Right. Well, I think the abortion issue was a factor in these elections, but it wasn't always the central factor. I don't quite get the his reference to the jury trial. But I think when you look at that, an awful lot of Americans are deeply ambivalent about abortion, and I think there is a kind of troubled majority that is uneasy about making abortion illegal. Because they see that abortion happens in there are large numbers of abortions in countries where abortion is illegal. I have even seen that there are more abortions performed in countries where abortion is illegal, but I suspect there may be a trick behind that data. But nonetheless, making abortion illegal does not end abortion. On the other hand, there are many of the same Americans who are quietly pro-choice are also unhappy with the number of abortions performed. And so that's why I think we are moving toward a different kind of discussion of this issue that takes seriously the serious moral claims that exist on both sides of this question. And to take both moral claims seriously is not to fudge the issue. It's to understand that this is an agonizing issue where the moral questions, there are serious moral arguments made by both sides.
Yeah, we have to say goodbye. EJ, thank you so much for all of your work.
Thank you. It's so great to be with you and all your callers.
Yeah, thanks. EJ Dion, our guest, the book is Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith in Politics After the Religious Right. It is published by Princeton University Press. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda for on-air production here in our studios. Thanks for listening, everybody. Till tomorrow.